Oh, friends, we have been talking about the Jesus path over these last many weeks, and we've come to Jesus' temptations and how Jesus' temptations remind us of the many serpentine side trails we are tempted to travel and walk in life. Last week, we talked about resisting the tempting side trail of the nemesis path, comparing ourselves, measuring ourselves against others. And even if we can extricate ourselves from the nemesis storyline, comparing ourselves to others, even if life isn't a competition, there's still a question. How can we know whether the things we do in life matter? If life isn't a competition, then how can we know whether the things we do in life, whether ourselves, matter? If there's no game, no competition, do my life and efforts and work and pursuits, did they mean anything at all? And I think without a concrete answer to that question, we're tempted to travel another dead-end side path, the path of allowing ourselves to be the judge and the jury of whether we and our lives matter. And that's a dicey proposition, because what it can mean is that our sense of mattering in life and our self-esteem, they're left to the turbulent winds, I would say, of our emotions. I mean, consider the phenomenon, I find this strange, of feeling emotions about ourselves. I find this strange and funny. We can feel mad at ourselves. We can feel proud of ourselves. That's a funny thing to me. I know I can be mad at other people because they externally do something. I can be mad or I can be happy with someone. We also feel that about ourselves, which I think is a very funny thing to consider. I know this happens to me virtually every day. There's night Brad and morning Brad. And morning Brad is frequently mad at night Brad for the decisions he makes. I stay up too late. I want to settle something once and for all. Yeah, you got to tell me here. How late is too late to be in bed reading with the light on? Like, is 1:30 too late to be? No, not alone. No, too late. Okay, Kristen thinks the same. There's a frequent conversation. And would you turn the light out? I'm trying to sleep. I'm like, but you don't understand, honey. Sleeping, wow, I don't like Kindles. I like a hard book. See, it's my favorite thing, because reading in bed combines two of my favorite things, reading and laying down. And I love those two things. And so, but every morning what happens is I'll stay up reading at 1 a.m, and then I wake up, right, kids up at 7, and the first thought is, I'm so angry at myself. Why? Why don't I just put the book down? I just find this a funny thing, that I can be somehow angry at myself or proud of myself. I live with the power to do certain things that create an emotional reaction from me about me. And when that happens, what we can do is we can end up traveling a path that tells us that the only thing that can validate my sense of worth is me. Consider self-esteem. It isn't an emotion per se, but emotions play a massive role in our experience of self-esteem. We can feel pride and delight in ourselves. For instance, this week, playing with the Nexus floor hockey team, I scored a hat trick. Well, you know what, Pam, that's... It's neither here nor there. I got to say, though, I felt great about myself in that moment, then stayed up too late that night, felt angry at myself the next moment. But this is self-esteem. It's not an emotion, but our emotions play a massive role in how we feel about ourselves. We feel pride, we can feel delight, we can be angry, we can be ashamed of ourselves. And our self-esteem tends to be a sort of average temperature of everything we feel about ourselves. The trouble with this is obvious, right? How we feel about ourselves is attached to our environment, our inner environment, but like the weather, it can fluctuate wildly. It can fluctuate based on a relatively insignificant happening. Someone can say to you an offhand remark that you take the wrong way, and suddenly, like, ooh, my self-esteem is in the gutter.
Self-esteem, it functions as this thermometer. It gauges how well we're doing in life. If I'm achieving my personal goals, I've got rich relationships, I generally feel good about myself, my self-esteem will rise. It feels good. I could pat myself on the back. I'm the judge and jury of whether I matter, and I'm doing well. But come to realize that you're still struggling with staying up too late like you did in your teens, in your 40s. You're still struggling with the same thing. And suddenly the thermometer can fall. We experience low self-esteem. And so our self-esteem almost gives us emotional feedback, you could say. It could be a bit of a roller coaster ride. It means our feelings of worthiness often rise or fall depending on the weather of our lives. And that's a really dicey proposition. Because what it means is that things kind of need to go pretty perfectly in life for us to feel significant and valuable and worthy. But we all know, right? Life is rarely perfect. We come from broken homes. We carry broken dreams. We experience rejection and failure. We have jobs that weary us, our calendars that stress us out. We're forever people, right, who start projects and don't finish them. And the average temperature of our self-esteem, it rides these highs and lows, and we can often feel like a mess. I say this, when our identity and worthiness depend on our self-esteem, we can end up deflated. But the Jesus path proposes to give us a way to find a stable self-esteem that doesn't fluctuate right with the weather of our lives. Because the truth is, as humans, we need to feel like we matter regardless of our personal success or failure, regardless of the wave of our emotions, no matter what the weather systems of life might be saying to us. Way back in the day, I was a young adult pastor, pastoring young adults. And I met Brian while I was hosting a weekly gathering called The Hostel. And Brian showed up, and it was only a short time before I found myself interacting with him quite regularly. And what became apparent very early on was that Brian was a compulsive liar. He lied about virtually everything. And his lies were wildly entertaining to me. But he told them with a stone-faced sincerity. And if George Costanza is right that a lie is not a lie, if you believe it, well, Brian certainly seemed to believe his own lies. Over the months, he regaled me with spectacular tales of his work. One day, I encountered him on the street, and he was wearing an FBI jacket, and he stopped me and said, "Brad, I work for the FBI. There's some trouble in the neighborhood. I'm going to need to stop you here until things are all clear." Meanwhile, another pedestrian just went right by. I didn't stop them. Just stop you here. Okay. Work for the FBI. We're in Canada. Like, all right. Later, he told me he worked for the Toronto Maple Leafs. He was a scouting agent doing some work for them, scouting out future prospects. What? One of my favorite was that he said he was a professionally trained wolf howler and that he had trained under the legendary wolf howler, Rick Strong. Constantly, every time I met him, lies. And he never broke character. His stories were so outlandish, but he told them with the conviction, right, of an old-time gospel preacher. And over time, I just couldn't figure out how to respond to his lies. And months later, after many, many lies, I'm standing talking to a group of young adults. They're all entrepreneurs. They've all started their own business over the summer. And Brian barges into the conversation and says, "You know, I started my own business this summer, too." Oh. "All right, what's your business?" He said, "It's a nighttime lawn mowing service." And I didn't like being the guy, but I couldn't resist playing along. "Wait, you mow lawns at night?" "Yeah, that's right. It's doing pretty good, I might add." "Wait, you actually mow lawns in the middle of the night?" "Yes, I start around 11 p.m., done by 5 or 6 a.m. "Wait, like, Brian, is this a commercial service or residential?" He said, "It's both." So, let me get this straight, Brian. You go to somebody's house while they're sleeping and mow their lawn in the middle of the night. He's like, "That's exactly right." Like, how do you see? He said, well, I strap a pair of flashlights onto the front of all the lawnmowers in our fleet. I said, fleet? How many? He's like, oh, I got 35 regular customers, but a dozen or so others part-time. I'm like, but why don't you just mow the lawns during the day? And he's like, everybody else does that. But Brian's night mowing lawn service allows you to enjoy your yard during the day, and I mow it at night. I'm like, this is so unbelievably far-fetched. I didn't know what to do. But no matter what questions I threw at him, he always had a fairly reasonable response to a ridiculous lie. And I was flustered because I headed home. I was telling Kristen about his most recent lie. And I said to her, I don't want to be the guy laughing behind his back. I don't want to be just always like, oh, Brian's crazy lies. What am I going to do? Should I just be like, dude, why do you lie so much? Like, should I confront him? Should I play along? I'll never forget what Kristen said. She said, why don't you just listen to his stories? I mean, what is the harm, Brad, in him telling you these stories? You know, he just wants to matter to you. He wanted to matter to me. And this was the thing about Brian. Brian was in his mid-20s, jobless, barely 5 feet tall. He suffered from some sort of learning disability. And what it meant is he lived at home with his parents, basically spent most of his days just walking around town doing nothing. And after Kristen's comment, I began to realize something about Brian. In a world full of people who desperately want to matter, how does someone like Brian matter when he has nothing in the way of things our culture deems as worthy? Like, if you're Brian, what do you do if you don't have a job, if you don't have friends, if you don't have kids, a spouse, if you don't have money, if you don't have intelligence, if you don't have Facebook and Instagram-worthy pictures of traveling? I mean, how do you matter if you have nothing our culture values? Brian's answer to that was, well, make up stories. Because in a world where walking around doing nothing doesn't matter, Brian decided to make up a story about the FBI, and I'll tell you, that's kind of matter. Anyone who worked for the FBI would be interested in talking to. Or in a world where, you know, what matters is our next adrenaline rush, he makes up a story about wolf howling. In a world where it matters what we do, our job or vocation, he makes up a story that, clearly a lie, is still kind of entrepreneurial. I've never heard of a night lawn mowing service. And Brian had nothing that typically mattered. He had very little to praise himself about to others, so he just made things up. Most of us have things. Family, work, accomplishments we can share. But though Brian's stories didn't fit with reality, I think what I learned is that Brian is really just like all of us. He just wanted to matter. And his stories were fake, or at least more transparently fake than many of our own, right? But he had nothing. We might have a degree, a new phone, a high-powered job, the new outfit, critical justice work in the community we're doing, the latest gossip, concert tickets, whatever it is, but Brian had nothing. And yet, I think what Brian shares with us is behind all of our stories, behind it all is a deep-seated insecurity, a dread that maybe in the end, none of it matters. And so our stories, our lives are often a way of saying to other people, look at me, pay attention to me. I want you to see me as interesting and worthy of attention. I want to matter to you. I've come to think that behind every set of eyes, every story I hear from others is really a longing to feel like we matter. Now, this might get confusing for a second, but hang with me here. What I find intriguing is this. For a person to feel like they matter in life, they must have faith in the thing in which they find their significance. Sounds a bit confusing, but I'm convinced of this. Life is way too short for people to pretend they're not religious. Like, we're just all religious. We really are. We're inherently religious people. We have faith systems, and every single person has a faith system. I must believe that what makes me matter actually matters. Let me give you some examples. If you're big into justice work, chances are you probably believe and hold to that there's some moral arc in the universe. I believe my justice work matters because I believe there's some sort of bigger justice at work. Or if some people, you know, talk about being on the right side of history, what I do matters because I'm on the right side of history. Well, you have to believe that there's a right and a wrong. Or I might say to you, if you ask me, Brad, why do you matter? Well, I could say, I know I matter because I'm a father. My kids, they depend on me. Fair enough, but for fatherhood to give me a sense of significance, I must trust and believe that being a father matters on some grand scale. I have to believe that caring for kids actually means something. But the reality is this, maybe the universe doesn't care. Maybe it doesn't care at all if I treat my kids well or not. It might be utterly meaningless in the grand scheme of things. I don't know. Maybe the way we treat our children is completely meaningless. But it makes me feel like I have meaning because it's a socially constructed narrative. It gives me solace from the fact that the cosmos might care less if I exist at all. And that, of course, leads to, if we let ourselves go down there, a bit of an existential angst, flirting with nihilism. And we could give many questions or many responses to the question of why we matter, but it's a good thing to ask ourselves once in a while, why does my life matter? And the moment you answer that, you've entered the realm of faith. Always faith. Trusting that whatever we put our sense of hope in for mattering is a belief system. Mattering in life is a matter of faith. We all need a sense of it, though, that we matter so that we can flourish in life. But we have to believe there's something outside of us that deems that worthy. And what the Jesus path, I think, proposes for us is this. You no longer need to feel like you are the judge and jury on whether you matter in life or not. You can be freed from that role. In Ephesians, Paul says this, "For by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not of your own doing, it's the gift of God, not the result of works, so that no one may boast. For we are what he has made us, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand to be our way of life." Notice the freedom here. And I know that, you know, in a place like this, anytime we talk about being saved, right, it's like, oh boy, what's Paul talking about here? We have been saved. What have we been saved from? For a lot of us, we immediately think of, I guess I've been saved from God's wrath or from hell, but I don't think that's what's going on here at all. What we have been saved from is thinking that our own efforts can determine whether we matter or not. Trying to prove our worth to ourselves or others is a dead-end path that ends in despair. Trying to, like, inflate every day our self-esteem day after day is to live under the tyranny of our own emotions. Our sense of mattering, Paul tells us in life, is pure gift. Pure gift. You matter just by virtue of being created. You don't have to play judge and jury. You don't have to play judge and jury of your own life. And I mentioned this earlier, talking about Jesus' baptism. I can't emphasize this enough. When Jesus receives his baptism blessing, it comes to him before he has done a single thing. I think that's so important. Because even if we're not comparing ourselves to others, we're like, I will matter when I succeed at this. Or I will matter once I've attained this. But Jesus receives his blessing before that. You matter, you're loved, you're delighted in before doing anything. Our identity and what makes us matter in life is not contingent upon what we do. And when we realize that, all of life becomes infused with meaning. In 1 Corinthians, Paul goes on to say this, I love it. "Therefore, my beloved, be steadfast, immovable, always excelling in the work of the Lord, because you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Believe what that means is this: nothing you do is wasted. And if you honestly let that sink in, it's quite the empowering notion. Nothing you do is wasted. You may think, whoa, Brad, I started that degree and I got 3 years in and then I quit and, oh, what a waste of time. No. Nothing's wasted in God's economy. God's economy doesn't have a dump that we send our trash and waste to. There is no dump. There's no waste in God's economy. You might say, but yeah, but I put in 5 years into that relationship and it ended, and now I feel like I wasted my time. But there's no waste in God's economy. Nothing is wasted. Your labor is not in vain. I mentioned earlier in the fall, right, that I had written this book. And late last year, a publisher picked it up, got signed. I'm very excited. So we're working on editing that, and hopefully it'll be out, I don't know, spring, fall, something like that, in the process. Yes, I'm excited. Feel good, right? Temperature, self-esteem, boom. But this week, it's like we're sending it out for authors to endorse. I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no. Because what if they don't like it? Or my bigger fear is this, because I think you can read between the lines and endorsements. And so I know what to look for, and I'm really scared. Because if an endorsement comes in, it's like, Brad's a nice guy. I'd be like, ah, they hate the book. Don't talk about me. Say good things about the book. I'm looking for it. We'll see. But this past Sunday and Monday, I was with the author, David Fitch. Brought him in with a couple pastors talking to him, which is lucky because he's one of the people that I have asked to endorse the book. The problem is he kept forgetting my name. So all time. He's like, thanks for sending me your book, John. I'm going to read that after. I'm like, I'm not John. Jeez, I'm not John. It'll be the worst thing. John's book is great. I'm like, ah. Was talking to him over these 2 days, and remember at the end, though he did say my name again wrong, John, listen. He said, I'm looking forward to reading your book. I'm sure I can help you out. He said, but you have to remember one thing. Always make sure that you're writing for you. That's how I write all my books, he said. Because if I write it for other people, I'll be disappointed with sales or blah, 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 blah. It's like, always write it for you as a way to organize your thoughts. And if it's for you, then nothing is wasted. I thought that's good advice, a good perspective to take on any creative endeavor that we do, but it was a great and healthy reminder that we can so easily set up measures and standards for ourselves and be like, I'll matter if somehow what I do achieves this. What Fitch reminds me of, what we're reminded of in Scripture is, no, that's such a wrong way to look at the world. Nothing is wasted. Nothing. So you might not hit your, you know, internal measuring bar, but it's not wasted. Nothing's wasted in God's economy, and that is so hard to get through our heads. And the side trail of trying to pump up our self-esteem is so tempting to travel, so hard to believe the promise of Jesus' path. But Jesus rises from the waters of his baptism with a posture of blessedness. He knows his life matters to God. He knows he's blessed, delighted in. But it's so hard for us to take on that mantle sometimes, because I would say this, for many of us, our mentality operates out of not a blessed consciousness, but a cursed consciousness. What do I mean by that? So often we associate cursing with bad words. And I think Ronald Rollheiser in a second is going to remind us that's not true, but I discovered this summer that I have somebody online who doesn't like me very much and has written a whole bunch of stuff about my sermons. Anyway, it's not very kind, but he emailed me and said, I want to ask you, Brad, to publicly confess to cursing in one of your sermons and ask for apology. He was talking about the F word that I used in talking about sin, which I will talk about a few weeks from now and use the same word again. So I didn't know who this guy was. And I said, nope, not gonna do that. It's the last I heard of him. But so often we associate cursing with curse words. And I wish, as somebody who swears a bit, I wish we could really clear this up. The words, the ones we've deemed taboo, are not curse words. Forbidden words are rather innocuous compared to what cursing actually is. Rollheiser really sums this up well for us. A curse is not the colorful language that comes out of our mouths when we get stuck in traffic or slice our golf ball the wrong way. What we say then may be in bad taste and highly profane, but it's not a curse. A curse is more pernicious. Cursing is what we do when we look at someone whom we don't like and think or say, I wish you weren't here. I hate your presence. I wish you'd go away. Cursing is what we do when we're affronted by the joyous screams of a child and we say, shut up, don't irritate me. Cursing is what we do when we look at someone and think or say, what an idiot, what a jerk. Cursing is what we do whenever we look at another person judgmentally and think or say, who do you think you are? You think you're an artist? You think you've got talent? You don't. You're full of yourself. Notice each of these examples that what is being said is the antithesis of what the Father said to Jesus at his baptism. You're my blessed one, in you I take delight. That's what it means to curse. It's not words. It's not a list of English words. It's to look and maybe say, but maybe even just send out the vibe, I don't want you here. You're not welcome here. I think you're full of yourself. And I think this, all of us in life at some point have experienced being cursed. And it's far more toxic than any list of bad words. I think some of our most profound moments come from being condemned and cursed early in life. And I think that if any of us could look over our life like as a series of episodes that have shaped our lives, what we would find is all the subtle little imperceptible ways we were cursed. We'd think through those times, whatever it was, where we encountered someone, whether they said it or just by the look in their eye, just by their energy, it was like, who are you? Go away. Shut up. You're not wanted here. You're not that important. You're full of yourself. And I think what happens in life is that we internalize these moments in life and they become part of our identity, our consciousness. Maybe nobody does have time for me. Maybe no one really is interested in me. I'm not wanted. I'm not significant. My life is dull, I guess. It's inconsequential. I guess my life in the grand scheme of things is a failure. Therefore, I must prove I matter to myself. And then we go through life setting up our, well, if I reach this standard, then I'll feel like I matter. But it's a dead-end path. A cursed consciousness, I think, leaves us feeling lost in the woods of life, no direction. But the Jesus path insists that we walk the path of blessing. And not only do we receive blessing, we matter, we're seen, we're delighted in, we're empowered, that then becomes our way of life. And I truly believe, though this work will always go unnoticed, but nothing's wasted in God's economy, some of the most important things we can do in life are the little acts of just with our posture or our words telling people, you're welcome here, you're blessed, I see you. And I find at least some things delightful about you. Having that presence. We matter because the creator of the cosmos has deemed us worthy. And more than that, the creator has called you to walk a path of meaning, ultimate meaning, where we then pass on the blessedness we receive to others. You matter, and nothing about your life or your work is wasted. I'm going to ask Carla to come and the band to come as well. We're going to head in time of Eucharist. She's just going to take us through that process, and then we'll meet you at one of these two stations, and the band will play us through.